I wanted to read this to you now. Remember, this is pre-big book. This is something that Dr. Bob dearly loved. It's from this book called The Greatest Thing in the World by Henry Drummond. And it's a description of the 1 Corinthians chapter 13. It's a lovely thing. If you want to try a spiritual experience with somebody that you love, try reading that. Now, this is the thing that you usually hear at marriages or sometimes at funerals about the aspects of love. Love is patient. So this is the windup of this address. And Drummond was a brilliant man. He was, anyway. Now I have all but finished.
Hooray!
How many of you will join me in reading this chapter once a week for the next 3 months? A man did that once and it changed his whole life. Will you do it? It is the greatest thing in the world. You might begin by reading it every day, especially the verses which describe the perfect character. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself. Get these ingredients into your life. Then everything that you do is eternal. It is worth doing. It is worth giving time to. No man can become a saint in his sleep, and to fulfill the condition required demands a certain amount of prayer and meditation and time. Just as improvement in any direction, bodily or mental, requires preparation and care, address yourself to that one thing. At any cost, have this transcendent character exchanged for yours. You will find as you look back upon your life that the moments that stand out, the moments when you really have lived, are moments when you have done things in a spirit of love. As memory scans the past, above and beyond all transitory pleasures of life, there leap forward those supreme hours when you have been enabled to do unnoticed kindnesses to those about you, things too trifling to speak about, but which you feel have entered into your eternal life. I have seen almost all the beautiful things God has made. I have enjoyed almost every pleasure that he has planned for me. And yet, as I look back, I see standing out above all that life that has gone 4 or 5 short experiences when the love of God reflected itself in some poor imitation, some small act of love of mine. And these seem to be the things which alone of all one's life abide. Everything else in our life is transitory. Every other good is visionary, but acts of love which no man knows about or can ever know about, they never fail.
So do you all have any questions for us?
Yes.
I've got an honest-to-God question.
We believe you.
We're ready. This is a question about something that I heard from Clancy. I only heard it once. I guess I've listened to 50 hours of this talk. So the stage is a sponsor. And I want to ask your opinion about whether this is concept. For those who don't know, Clancy has a reputation as being a very directional sponsor. Directive sponsor. And I remember the talk where he said, he called me a dictator. He said, but that's a bunch of crap. Because all the little smarts have to do is say, you're fired. He said, but it's like a relationship that goes through stages, sponsorship. He says, at first you're holding on to somebody's hand like a child and telling them, be safe, and don't worry, you know, do this and you'll be okay. He said, and then as you grow up, you get to a point where you're in an adolescent relationship and where there's a lot of, what? I got to do that? And there's a lot of back and forth and argument and you know, like teenage years. And he said, if you get through that, it develops into something else. A relationship between people, you know, at a much more different and adult level. And I'd never heard sponsorship described that way before until I heard it. And I wondered if you would think that's a realistic...
You know, I think that one of the situations that's changed in my life, or all of our lives probably in the last 10 to 15 years, is when all the young people started coming into AA. In our area, there's just a flood of them. And like we've jokingly talked about them taking over our meeting, you know, it's not really that funny. So they really have. And but when they first started coming into our meeting, they were asking us to sponsor them. And my first reaction, initial reaction to that is, what am I going to do with this child? Some of them are 16 years old. You know, that's... I'm in my 60s, you know, late 50s then, mid-50s. And I was a bit put off by it. My experience with it is that when you're sitting across the table from them reading the book, the age difference truly goes away. It's a different relationship. But many of them are looking for a father figure. They've never had that really in their life, or not a healthy one. And it became apparent to me that that's what was happening, the way they were acting around me and stuff. Not all of them, but some of them. It was very much like that. At first, it made me feel very old. Then I realized I'm not a father figure, I'm a grandfather figure. I'm old enough to be the parent of their parents. Remember, this one guy invited me. He says, my parents are coming into town. I really want them to meet you. So I'm nervous about meeting the parents. They were my kids' age. Mom was looking pretty good, actually. I was shocked by that. I was like, God damn, I got old. Well, this relationship, this father-son kind of thing, very sweet. Really nice. Real... You know, I mean, there's a couple of them that would just come up and throw their arms around me, and I just put my hand, just hold their head, and just, we'd walk around like that. It was really sweet if you open yourself up to it. And then they look at you like you're just this sage, and then they realize after a while that you've stolen all this stuff from other people, that you're really not that sharp, you know, and you watch them grow up. Emotionally, some of them were more emotionally advanced than me, and then you hit that adolescent stage, you know, where they're breaking free, they're on their own. And we were talking about Maverick. You know, Maverick's all grown up now, and he asked him to be his sponsor. It broke my fucking heart. He's moving to Seattle. You know, I'm losing my boy. You know, it's like that, but it's sweet. It's sweet. You know, it's So yes, I agree that that relationship does go through stages and phases. I think what we do that hinders that process is many of us will try and maintain a certain relationship the way we perceive that it should be. And when they try to attach themselves to us, we will push them away, because it's not supposed to be like, I don't want you to be dependent on me, is what you hear a lot. That's really not what's going on. They're trying to connect, and they're using you for that vehicle. And, you know, it fairly quickly I learned, I go, I can do this. This is something I can do. You want me to be that for you? I can do that. You know, sometimes I'm the mad dad, you know. Sometimes they don't behave correctly, and I go, sit down, you're grounded. You know, it's like, sometimes it's like that, you know. But I think they look, like they say, kids seek out discipline. I think that's true. You know, I mean, when they get to the point where they trust you and they realize you're not trying to hurt them or to cage them in, they listen to you and they follow your lead. You know, you tell them how to behave in the meeting why did you say that to that? You know, whatever it might be, they'll listen to you because they trust you. And so it's interesting. It's interesting. It can be a little intimidating sometimes.
I agree with that. I was thinking after you read that, if that's my experience, and it's my experience sponsoring people. I mean, I can think of, you know, we talked about Liver Mike. You know, he really wanted to know, what do I do today? What do I do tomorrow, right? And then when I told him maybe since he was having trouble finding a job, he should volunteer as a paralegal, he got really angry. And I said, "But you haven't done anything for months. Why don't you volunteer?" And he did it, but it was that adolescence. And now he sponsors many people. He's well-respected, and we check in. But then I thought, is it my experience with Bill? And I'll tell you, you know, like Bill said, I used to go to Bill in pretty early sobriety. I was 2 or 3 years sober and get direction, you know, and work through the steps. And then we did the Seething Cauldron where we all did fifth steps. So did that. In fact, I had an awakening. You know, I didn't remember really being physically abusive to the mother of Phoebe until I was like 6 years sober. That first time it came out was to him. And that reminds me of Rocky from the Gong Show used to say, you know, when you're 1 year sober and you do a inventory, you say, well, I stole a bunch of rope. And then when you're 7 years sober, you say, well, there are a bunch of horses attached to it. You know, and it isn't that you were lying, it's that you were in denial. But, you know, before I moved to Washington, I'm very, very uncomfortable with myself about some behavior. Really severely alienated from myself. And, you know, now I'm somebody in AA, right, which I watched happen to my brother. So I took Bill aside before I left, and I told him this stuff that I really didn't like about myself. And we had changed in our behavior because he looked at me for a long time silently, and he said, do you know how much I love and respect you? He didn't tell me what to do. He didn't judge me. It was nothing like any of the other fifth steps I did. And so we're adults now. And that really helped me a lot to go up there being completely clean with somebody and being particularly clean with this guy who I've known for 20 years intimately. So yeah, that's my experience, just like Clancy said. I hate to agree completely with Clancy, but I do.
I think I just did 10 minutes on that last session.
Yeah.
I have two questions. One is if you have a sponsee that is not drinking, but they're taking a mind-altering drug, do you address that? Do you keep bringing it up? Do you keep sponsoring them?
Is it a mind-altering drug that has been prescribed?
Yes.
Okay. That makes a difference.
Yes. Do you have any expectations or stipulations when you first sponsor somebody? You know, that you say, you know, you must do this or be this before I will sponsor you. Those are my two questions.
Well, since I'm not a doctor, I stay away from that as much as I can. Because I don't get new people as much anymore, I don't get folks that have been prescribed medication to help bridge them into sobriety or, you know, help them come off whatever those detoxings are. I can tell you from experience in my own family how difficult it is for people that have surgeries and real difficult pain management problems, the amount of judgment and abuse they get from people in the fellowships, all based on fear. So our friend Scott used to say, you know, first of all, is their name on the pill bottle? That's the first most important thing. The second thing is later on going from having it be from a physician to maybe a psychiatrist, because there's a difference. And if we have no idea, you know, I mean, the psychotropic drugs today are so much different than they were. Now, I can tell you that I used to have an opinion about people not, you know, being completely clear of mind-altering drugs. There was a man who lived in the, I lived in an apartment down on the Strand in Hermosa Beach. There was a man next door who was manic depressive, I think, or bipolar. I can't remember what it was that he was, but he would occasionally stop taking his medication, be a sober guy, going along just fine, he'd stop taking his medication, then he'd end up medicating himself with alcohol. Okay? And one night he decided that the best foreplay that he could come up with the young woman that he'd brought home with from the bar, was to show her a gun that he happened to have, and the gun just discharged and went through the wall from his apartment into mine. This completely changed my experience with people being on medication. From then on, it was like, yes, please take your meds. Okay. We never had any problem like that, you know. So I had an opinion, and then I had an experience, and it changed my opinion. So I mean, that's kind of it. Now, on the other hand, I can tell you that I was newly sober. You remember Bob R., big tall guy that was
Bob Ryan.
Yeah.
Oh, please strike that from the record.
Yeah. Well, I'm just sitting here.
It's Bill C., don't worry. Anyway, so this man asked me to sponsor him, and I said, okay, I'll sponsor you. And I said, I see that you're taking medication, and I think you need to get off of that medication before I can sponsor you. And so he was confused. He wanted to be sober. This is probably 1986, 87, and so he says he's confused, so he calls his doctor, and his doctor called me up and just hammered me. Who do you think you are, man? This guy's in real trouble, and blah 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 blah. And so, you know, okay, well, I won't sponsor him. Sorry, you know, I made amends to Bob for not, you know, going to med school and all that stuff. 20 years later, he comes up to me and he says, you know, I've been off the psychotropic drugs now for about 4 years. And he said, you know, I never could get a spiritual connection because of the masking agents and the medications that I was on. So he said, you were right, but I was in no position to do that. So again, this idea of what's our role? Our role is to love people where they are. We meet people where they are. We don't coddle their behavior, nor do we say, oh, you've got the green card. Sure, you can smoke, you can vape marijuana in the parking lot before you come in the meeting. I mean, that's not what we're doing, but we need to meet people where we are and assist them in their spiritual evolution.
And the thing about, you asked about, do I have any requirements? I think that's an interesting question. So I prefer if someone's really new that they call me every day. And I have to have set times because I get a lot of calls. So if you ask me to sponsor you today, you'd have to call me at 6:45 because that's the time I have available. And if you don't do that, we don't talk. And some people say, well, why do you want that? And it's really a willingness exercise. It's not because I need to talk to you every day. Sometimes those conversations are 30 seconds long. But more often than not, when someone says, I'm just checking in, and I ask two questions, they go on for 25 minutes. It's like, well, okay, yeah, I did some stuff, but I forgot to tell you about. But that's really why. I mean, I was listening to Sandy Beach the other day on a CD, and he goes, you know, why do you go to a meeting when you don't want to go to a meeting? To exercise your humility. So you remember to be humble. And so that's one thing. And, you know, I don't fire them if they don't call me every day. Some people do call me every day. Some people call me every third day and imagine in their minds they're calling me every day. And then, you know, we're in a weird position where we travel all over. I like for people to meet me at a meeting. Once a week at least. I'll tell you, we've all had this experience where somebody asked us to sponsor them because they heard us speak at a conference. 99% of the time that doesn't work. Because first of all, they're hearing a certain image that they think is going to be the daily experience with us. And secondly, you know, I played in a rock and roll band. I'm not stupid. And then there's an image, and then there's reality, right? And then we don't see them, right? I've had two go successfully long distance. We Skype. We'll read the book. We can do it. But if you're new, meet me at a meeting and call me every day.
I don't have any requirements. I mean, I don't tell them up front, okay, if I'm going to be your sponsor, you've got to do these two or three things. I don't do that. After a while, I will say to somebody, what's this relationship all about? What are we doing here? What do you mean? Well, I never see you, and you never call me. You know, if you were my sponsor, I would go to your home group.
Yeah.
Of course. It's just a foregone conclusion. That's, I want what you have. I'm going to enter your world. And people that give me a hard time about that, you know, eventually I'll bring that up if that's the way the relationship is going. And they give me a hard time about it. And I go, well, clearly you don't want what I have. It's obvious to me. I don't know how you feel about it, but it's real obvious to me. Because I don't want what you have. you know, I'll tell them that. You know, I'm not. If you asked me for help, what you really want is you want some aspect of my life. You have this image, whatever it might be. I mean, the downside to being a circuit speaker kind of person is they expect that you're going to be wise all the time. You know, which all you got to do is sit in my backyard with me for an hour or two. You know, and but I don't. He never had any requirements of me. He never had to require anything of me. I just stuck my hand in his back pocket and followed him around like a puppy dog for a pretty solid 3 years. You know, and when nobody was doing that with me, I went, "What's wrong? Don't you love me?" He's like, you know, the medication thing is. The hard thing about medication, about people on medication, is it's really hard to work the steps when you're dead. And I've witnessed real bipolar stuff. I've seen it. I've also believed that I know a lot of people that are medicated that don't need to be. But that's just my opinion. So what? So I think that, you know. One of the things I've learned about myself is that people have problems I don't have. And if they have a problem I don't have, for some odd reason, I think they're faking it or something. I still can't put my finger on that. You know, clearly you're full of shit. You know, and I just think that, you know, just for no apparent good reason. There's no backup for it. And most of the time I'm dead wrong. I really get into it. I got a guy right now, although I haven't talked to him in a while, who's on Suboxone, coming off opiates. And he's a product of the psychotherapeutic community. He's got a therapist. He's in an outpatient program. He spends all of his time talking to me about his paranoid delusions and what's going on. It's hard to get him to sit and read the book with me. The Suboxone thing, I asked him, I said, why are you taking that? And he says, well, the people at the outpatient program want me to take it. They think it would be good for me. He says, I don't really want to take it, but they want me to do it. So I'm going along with it. And that happens a lot, where these kids hear, take this. And they're not asking for it. It's being handed to them. That's the way the medical community treats addiction problems and stuff, is with more medication. I absolutely disagree with that. I think that's really a bad approach. So what? So I disagree with it. You know, like Jay says, you meet them where they are. So he says to me, do you think I'm sober? because he's conflicted. He's not sure. And I said, what do you think? And he goes, well, I'm not sure. He says, but what I'm thinking is that when I finally am weaned off of it, that's when I'll start my sobriety date. I go, that's a good plan. I mean, I don't argue with him. I mean, he could go either way. If he, you know, it's okay with me. I don't care. It's up to you. You know, I mean, if there's anything that we have to be sure about, it's our sobriety. You know, I mean, I know that on March the 27th, from that point forward, I have not consciously taken anything that would alter my consciousness. I've been in the hospital many times in the last few years, and I've been on morphine several times for extended periods of time. At first, it was kind of a giggle. It's kind of fun, a freebie. And, you know, really, I mean, that's the way we think. That's the way my friend Ed was right at the end. You know, it was really sweet. Sweet for us, you know. It's like, but I'll tell you this. After about the second or third day, I didn't like it anymore. I've been clear for a long time. I've gotten used to it. And I don't like all that foggy crap. I don't want to be cut off from the sunlight of the spirit. It doesn't work for me anymore. It's not a party. And my sense is that they're the same way. They've just been raised in an environment where this stuff is treated with chemicals, you know. And I think the pendulum will swing back around sooner or later.
My wife was... has, aside from her marriage, has had a lot of different problems in her life, and her original sponsor was a psychotherapist and a very talented woman, and she said, "We're going to work the steps now." She says, "Mental illness masks alcoholism. Is you know much of it alcoholism looks like mental illness. This is why they give this stuff to all these, because drug addiction and, you know, you're going to be depressed, this, that, and another thing." She said, "You have to work the steps right now so we can decide whether it's mental illness or whether it's alcoholism." And so that's why we're moving quick.
So, you know, one thing, a subtext to something you said earlier, because they're handling the medication thing really well, yeah. But a big learning for me as far as sponsees doing what I tell them, right? And, you know, I remember a sponsee came to me and he was almost in tears and said, "I'm so sorry I lied to you." And I'm like, "Yeah, you're the first sponsee that's ever lied to me." But the subtext might be that I'd like to address, and it was a good learning for me, was, you know, two things. One is that, I'll take this guy, Toothless Tim, lived in my trailer for a while, right? And we bought him teeth, and then he sat on them and broke them. But I would call Bill, and I go,
"We also call him Barnyard."
Yeah, for olfactory reasons. But when you're, he was living with me, I'm helping him get his car fixed, I'm helping get him work, and doing all this stuff, and I was telling Bill, I was complaining about it. You know, I'm like, you know, the guy's not, I'm doing 10 times more than he's doing for his own recovery. And he was sober a long time when he moved into my trailer, over 10 years. And he said, "So let me get this straight. Tim's sobriety is not living up to your expectations." And that's pretty clear that I'm at fault, right? I let Tim go his separate ways. He, some other stuff happened between us, but he, you know, I didn't, that wasn't a position I should have put myself in, and it's none of my business. Yeah. Secondly, the thing about them not doing what you want, they ask you to sponsor them, and then they call and complain about their lives, right? This is a pretty good mechanism. If they're calling you every couple of days or every week and complaining about everybody and their everything, and they're not showing up to read the book, and they're not going to the meetings they say they're going to go to, there's a very short window where that is allowed in my life. And then I say, "Look, you asked me to sponsor you. I have Alcoholics Anonymous to offer you. There are 12 steps. I am not going to listen to your stuff anymore until you do something to change. And like Bill says, if you don't want what I have, let's part ways. If you want what I have, you need to start doing what I do, because I'm not going to listen to you anymore." Right? There's a line. And that sometimes I think might be what you're driving at.
Just quickly, too, I had this guy that he was a tweaker, and he tweaked a lot. And he lost the entire month of November. He doesn't remember anything that happened in November. So he's coming over. We're reading the book together. And one day he says to me, my therapist thinks that I'm depressed and that I should get some medication to treat my depression.
Yeah.
What do you think? Well, like I mentioned before, I can form an opinion on the fly. You know, it's easy for me. But I asked him a couple of questions. I really thought about it, and I'm aware of the fact that I'm not a doctor. I really am not. But I'm looking at this guy, and he doesn't seem that bad to me. I've seen people that are really down, like really depressed, you know. He didn't seem that way, and I asked him, I said, well, are you suicidal? Are you having suicidal thoughts? He goes, no. I said, are you homicidal? Are you thinking about taking anybody out? And he goes, no, not really. And I said, well, maybe you're depressed because you're just a loser. And he looked at me, and he went, and he kind of smiled, and he went, good point. You know, after what he had told me, it's like hard to argue with, you know. I mean, sometimes depression is the appropriate emotional response. Last night, him and I sat up till after midnight for my birthday. And we don't see each other so much anymore. We see each other, but we don't get a lot of quiet time. And I was talking to him about how I was feeling about my health problems and all. I'm on a liver transplant list, you know, and I'm sick a lot, and I get depressed. I get down, you know, and I'm not depressive by nature, you know. I'm a homicide guy. I'm not a suicide guy, you know. It's like, you know, and I was talking to him about it. One of the things he said to me is something, this happens a lot. When you've been sponsored by someone a long time, or you sponsor a lot of people, where they'll tell you something you already know because you've told other people, but you're not applying it to yourself. You know, I mean, it's head knowledge, you know, and I'm sometimes good at diagnosing you, not so good at diagnosing me. And one of the things he told me last night, he says, well, you know, you're sick, man. You know, depression goes along with that. You don't feel good about it. That's okay. You can beat it. It won't kill you. And I think the medical community looks at it like, oh, shit, you're depressed. Take these. You know, maybe you just need to be depressed for a while because your life is depressing. You know, that's different than people that suffer from depression. That's a different animal. You know, there are people that have, for whatever reason, you know, there's a lot of argument now as to whether it truly is a chemical imbalance. I don't think they think that's true anymore now. But there are people that suffer from something other than what I do. And that's a different animal. And I need to stay out of that. But kind of logic, I mean, I think logic can play. Like you, after some years of dealing with a lot of different people, you build up some experience.
Right.
You can identify certain things. I've sponsored two guys that are like stone cold schizophrenics. When you see that, that's some mental illness, man. That's like gnarly, except really intriguing. I get absolutely fascinated by it. Like, what are they giving you now, man? Are you hearing voices? What do they say? You know, it's like, and they'll tell you, they'll talk to you because they don't want to be schizophrenic. This one poor guy, I know I'm going on here, I'm sorry, but this one poor guy was sitting across from me in my little ashram out in the backyard. Ashram is where we smoke and meditate. And he looked up at me, and his head was down, his mouth is kind of half open because he's so medicated. And he looks up to me, and he's got tears in his eyes, and he goes, will this help me? And it just broke my heart. I mean, how much they suffer.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not having a good time, you know. And I looked at him, I didn't know what to say, and I said, I'm not sure, but I know it won't hurt you. And we just kept reading, you know. And And there's a lot of injured people out there. And when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to be there. For that, I'm responsible. You know, and you just do your best.
And that's part of the issue, is that because you have alcoholism, like, healthy people don't want to be on medication. My wife had a stroke, right? I didn't know this. She didn't know this. But they put you on an antidepressant as soon as you get to the hospital, because you're going to wake up paralyzed. And that can be quite overwhelming for your psychology. So we didn't know. We had enough on our plate. We didn't know. I didn't read all the crap they were giving her. And she gets out of the hospital 5 weeks later, and she says, I can't feel my feelings. I said, really? And she said, yeah, I feel like I'm behind glass. This is a healthy person's response to being on an antidepressant. So I looked at her medications. I go, oh, you're on antidepressants. She goes, why? I said, I don't know why. So let's go to your doctor. So we go to the doctor, and she says to the doctor, I don't want to be on this antidepressant. And he said, well, you've had a stroke. You've had a terrible malady that's going to affect you, and we put those on you to protect you. And she goes, what is it with California? You're not supposed to have a big cry over anything?
And that's great.
And he laughed and said, I've never met many people like you. And he said, I don't stop taking them all together, you'll have a big cry over losing your keys. Because they're psychotropic meds. If you stop in one day, like I said, we've made that mistake in AA, yeah. Just stop, and then they crash. So my wife did not cry at my parents' funeral. I mean, my wife loved my parents. She's just British. So, yeah, I gave her half a pill. And we went the next day to see my oldest daughter in a play. The curtain opened. My wife burst into tears. And I said, what have you done with my wife? And she said, shut the fuck up. And she hasn't been on antidepressants. She's been paralyzed, partially paralyzed for almost 15 years. And she hasn't been on antidepressants. Does she struggle? Hell yes. But not like that. She can get out of bed. She doesn't want to hurt herself. She's, you know, she just gets ornery. She doesn't like it that she forgets everything. She doesn't like it that she can't wear high heels. You know, those kind of things. But that's not depression. That's different. So we've sure beaten that question into the ground. Does anybody do we have any other questions?
Anything about not drinking?
Oh, yeah.
Give us one snippet.
Yeah, we give it an example. Because, you know, when they're dying, you do go to the hospital. Yeah.
Well, no, just like relationships, friendships, pregnancy, whatever.
For instance. Well, I'll go and then the big guys will take it. But one of the things Bill taught me, and I learned it over and over again because I want to save people, is he said, don't get sucked into their drama. You know, my first sponsor, I thought he was stupid. You know, I picked him on the fly at a meeting, and I go to his house and I go, you know, I owe like $18,000 to this guy, and I have this baby, and I can't stand looking at the mother of my baby, and my mom has cancer. And he go, yeah, we're on page 7. And I'd be like, God, this guy's stupid. He's like an idiot savant or something. And then we'd read the book. And I get done, and I would forget, and I go home, right? Then I come back, and I go, oh, my God, the IRS figured out where I live now, and I'm in a lot of trouble, and I think the police are after me. And he'd go, did you read Bill's story last night? I'd be like, God, this guy's an idiot, you know? And then I got done with the steps, and all that stuff was fine. Does that help answer your question? Mm-hmm. Keep them in. This is what you have to offer, the book and the program. They want us to be their marriage counselors. And like Bill says, yes, you have opinions. But I remember my wife saying to me once, I love women. I love women probably way too much, right? I think they're the evidence of God. But
a loving God.
A loving God.
A vengeful God.
But I was sponsoring all these men and talking to my wife, like, oh, man, you should hear what this guy's up to. And she goes, you know, you've become a real misogynist. Because I was hearing one sick guy describe a relationship. And oddly enough, the woman always came off looking terrible. And as I've gotten, stayed sober longer and actually gotten to, like, had dinner with people and their wives and been to babies being born, I'm like, she's pretty good. I got involved, opinionated and emotionally involved in something I had no business forming opinions about. Is that helpful?
Absolutely.
Okay. They will come to you and talk about their partner or friend or employer in a negative way. Because in order for the alcoholic life to seem like the only normal one, it has to be someone else's fault. You can never take responsibility for your own behavior, because your own behavior is indefensible. So you have to make it someone else's fault. It's that bitch I live with. It's my asshole employer. It's that neighbor next door that his tree's coming over into my yard. You know, it's always based in that. That if this outside me was different, then I'd be okay. That's an illusion. It's a lie. It's not true. I've learned over the years, when you come to me and tell me, every time, no matter how long you've been sober, if you come to me and tell me, my boss is an asshole, I immediately don't believe you. I mean, before you finish the sentence, I do not believe that's true. He probably asked you to take that box and move it over there, and you can't talk to me like that. I mean, that's the emotional immaturity. I'm like that. You know, when I would go to him, one time Karen and I got into a fight. I mean, we would have screaming F-U fights. I mean, the last time we had one, which was years ago, we both went into separate rooms and started laughing at the same time because it was just so ridiculous. Neither one of us remembers what they were about at all. We were just screaming in each other's face, you know, and we ran out of language, so we just cussed. You know, it's like, and I call him for an emergency counseling session. I drive to Rocky Cola. He drives up there, gets in my truck, right? And I go off. I go, that bitch, she said this, and she said that. And I went on for, and he's sitting there in the cab, just looking at me, like, blank stare, like, wow, you know? Because I'm jacked up. This is it. This is the end. You know, I'm going to get rid of her or kill her, or both, you know? Bury her in the backyard, and, you know, let the dogs eat her. You know, it's like, I'm pissed, really, nice. Really pissed, you know? And I'm just going on about it. I'm going on about it, you know. And then I finally catch my breath and I look at him and I go, so what do you think, you know? And he says to me, I can't believe that the woman that you claim is your soulmate, that she has healed you sexually and brought such love into your life, that you can speak about her in those terms. And I told him, I said, yeah, but she said, this is what she said. You know, you're not hearing me, stupid. You're not hearing me. She said, you can't say that to me. I have to defend myself. I have pride, you know. And he just looked at me and he says, I can't believe. And he just wasn't interested in my analysis of the situation at all. He's only, has only ever been interested in my behavior. And he would tell me, Bill, you can't talk to people like that. It's not right. But she said, you know, I don't care. I don't care. That's what I do with guys. You know, I don't. So in that sense, in their relationships, I try not to get involved in the debate of analyzing what's going on in this other person's mind who is not present when we're having this conversation. And I don't know him or her at all. I only know this guy. What could I possibly add to that conversation that it would have any validity at all? You know, so it, to me, it's about me and you. That's it. How are you behaving? How are you treating people today? And if she's that bad, why are you there?
Yeah. What is it with you?
Why do you, if she's really that bad, why are you still there?
You know, Bill's illustration reminds me of something Jay's wife Adele said at a retreat we're at that it's just beautiful. She said, I don't call them character defects anymore. I call them character defenses. They're these defenses that are trying to defend some character that I think I am. And you know, that's whole bill, you know what she said to me kind of stuff. It, you know, the great line in the 12 and 12 and the seventh step, my favorite thing in the 12 and 12 is, the chief activator of my character defects is self-centered fear. Fear that I'm going to lose something that I have, or fear that I'm not going to get something I demand. And almost all of their drama is right there. And that's why sticking in the solution, sticking in your side of the street, staying in the what's your part in it, is the only healthy approach. And I, believe me, have gotten sucked into drama, you know. And,
oh, me too.
And I feel like you almost get sent people that are going to push that button in you. You know, I got, this is a journey for us, right? And I get people like, you know, I yelled at a sponsee and I called him. I felt terrible. And he goes, sometimes you just yell at him. You know? But when I yelled at him three times in a row, I'm like, I think this might be me, you know, not him. And he was pushing buttons in me, and I had to grow up.
And I guess,
okay. Yeah, yeah. Anybody else? Yes. Are you sponsoring people?
Me? Yes.
Jay?
Well, I think that, you know, back to this, there are different phases that we go through. And the solution is always outside of myself, as far as working with others and trying to be helpful. So if I'm feeling alienated, then what I do is I find somebody to be compassionate with. I go and find another sponsee. And then I grow my own little farm around me because I'm no longer connected to my sponsor in the same way. You know, we have this illusion when we're sitting here that we're, you know, we went to meetings for years together. And because I don't smoke cigars, I wouldn't have that many intimate conversations with Bill because he would be, you know, he would be in his nest outside with, you know,
he's just
forth.
A lower level of spirituality.
So, you know, I'd have to go directly into the meeting room so that I didn't have to shower when I came home. You know, it's just self-protection. But anyway, so the thing is that this is a lonely life. And you're in a fellowship, and we have all this activity, and we have these relationships and all that stuff. But there are times when it's just you. And first we need to learn to be good with that, and then allow our fellowship to grow up around us, and then not be so attached to that fellowship that's the only thing that gives us our thing. You know, I mean, I can't tell you what it was like to be the oldest guy left going to the meeting in all the groups that I went to. Where'd they go? Was it me? Or why is it that's that? And you know, you don't get the respect you deserve from your sponsees. They're not calling you correctly. And I mean, that goes all the way across the board. But there were, you know, there are always two or three, but there's a, and I don't know if it's a hallmark of my own evolution, my own path. I don't know that, but I know that, that the relationships, almost every relationship that I'm in on any level that I'm the one that reaches out to call them. And so I have to take responsibility for that on two levels. Number one, if I want to be in relationship, I got to make the call. And number two, being spiritually mature enough to realize that that is my life and to be good with, learn to be good with that. Because sometimes I've tried to teach him and haven't called him for 3 months. He didn't even fucking notice.
Well, that's not completely true. He, when I was going to his house reading the book with him, we finished. And he told me, he says, "You don't have to come over Thursdays anymore. Go forth." And I barely remember driving home from that feeling abandoned, feeling I was heartbroken, you know. I mean, I had a lot invested in this relationship, you know. I'm following him around, and he told me not to come around. And I took it very personal. And I didn't know what to do with that feeling. You can't show that when you're a tough guy. You can't show it. You can't really share that with anybody, and people laugh at you. So I thought. And I didn't know you were all feeling the same way. You know, it's like, and what I had to do is create my own cadre. And part of that was I went through a period where it became apparent to me I had no friends. I had these very shallow AA relationships. And the way that we make them seem intimate is we talk about heavy stuff with each other. And all that really is just us talking about ourselves again. You know, it really isn't intimacy. It's just talking. It's just talking. And I'm sitting, and I'm thinking, God, I have no friends. I don't have any friends. I've got these guys that I sponsor, but that's kind of almost a parasitic sort of relationship, you know. And there's no depth in my life. There's no emotional connection. I really felt that, and I started talking about it to some people. And my wife said to me, she says, you know, if you want to have friends, you got to be one. Mm-hmm. And he's right. I don't call. I expect you to call me, and when you don't, I get lonely, and it's your fault, you know. So I started calling. I started, you know, trying to form relationships with people. I was somewhat successful, but at that time, the relationships I tried to form with the people I tried to form them with, I don't have those relationships anymore. And I realized I was adapting myself to get along with people that I thought were cool, that I should be with. I didn't know how to just naturally gravitate towards people that were naturally gravitating towards me. I mean, if you were gravitating towards me, there must be something wrong with you. You know, these are core beliefs that we have about ourselves that we're not really conscious of. These are the character defects. And there, many of them are very subtle and deep. You know, the more the awareness increases, the more you can see it. So I started trying to pay attention to. I realized that I would walk into a meeting room. There'd be people that would come right up to me. "Hey, Bill, how you doing?" And I'd be looking across the room thinking, I should be with them. I don't want to hang around with these nerds. And I looked at that. I could see it. And I go, what is that? What is that? And I started hanging around with the nerds, you know, with those people that were naturally gravitating towards me. And I developed some friendships, you know, people that...
Some beautiful ones.
Yeah, people that love me, and I love them. We're unapologetic about it. But it takes some time. And where you are right now is the apron strings have been cut, and you're cast adrift, you know. And now you're going to go through a series of experiences, and you'll begin to really learn how to form real relationships. And some of them will be successful, and some of them won't. That's how we learn.
Anybody else before we break?
You got some questions.
Yes, yeah, it's the same question you asked me yesterday. I'm not going to answer.
No.
Okay.
Ever tried to force personal growth and fail at it?
Force somebody else's personal growth or my own?
Personal.
Yes. Next question. Well, I'm glad you asked that. Where did that come from? I got a degree in English literature. And I don't even know if this is what you're asking, but I'll tell you my experience is that for years and years and years, we'll take a couple of examples. I wanted to go to the gym and get in shape. I've never been terribly out of shape, although, yes, my son will disagree with you. But then all of a sudden, one day, I started going to the gym. Not on my schedule, not when I wanted to 5 years before that, and it was easy, right? For a long time, I pursued meditation. I went on retreats, and I read books about it from when I was in high school. And then because I think I kept it above the horizon as something I wanted to do and realized that I really am not in charge, I'm not the doer, right? In my spiritual evolution, I'm beginning to realize that more profoundly. But keeping it up, hearing it, this call of it, and keeping it above the horizon and fumbling towards it, you know, loving clumsily the things I'm trying to love, they come to fruition at a different time. So when you say force growth, I mean, I don't think I've done that in a long time, but I try to be open to the fact that, hey, maybe these things I really want to be, like a regular meditator, somebody who calls, somebody who listens better. I'm a terrible listener. Terrible. Somebody who listens better. Just keeping that above the horizon, it's like grace comes. So that's my answer, is that, yes, I've tried. I don't think it was foolish to try. And later on, things kind of fell into place.
I would hear people talk about, early on, I started meditating and trying to sit cross-legged and be a yogi and became vegetarian and ate nothing but fruit. You know, it was fun. It was fun. It was like discovering a whole new world. And then I got away from it and I just stopped doing all of it. And at 20 years sober, when I went on the interferon, or a little before then, I was really sick. I got really sick. And there was no prayer, there was no meditation. It hadn't been for a long time.
That's not from sponsor direction, by the way.
And he told me to stop meditating. And, but my friend Christophe Dupin de Saint-Cyr, he's French, therefore he's an asshole. He's one of my dearest friends. He's one of those people that I've really bonded with. And this was kind of part of that process. He came over to my house, walked in the door because I was depressed. I couldn't get out of the house. Everybody was kind of concerned about me, which I wasn't really aware of, per se. And he brought me The Power of Now. And he said, read this, God damn it. You know, I said, you know, I've read non-dual stuff. You know, I like all that stuff. I said, okay, I'll read it. So I had to go lead a spiritual retreat in Hawaii right after that. This is strange. And I read the book. And I got really intrigued by it. I mean, it really nailed me. I mean, I was ripe for it. So I went there, and I went up the side of this hill, and I sat on this thing, and I meditated. And I meditated, the way I describe it is I meditated with intent. And what I mean by that is I need help. Please help me. I'm hurting, and I need some help. And I was trying to connect. And I opened my eyes, and I saw the wind blowing through the trees across this beautiful valley where he's going there in about a month. And it's just beautiful. And I just got it. It just hit me, you know. And it's very difficult to describe, but I just connected. I plugged in. And everything changed. And it has not been the same since, really. Now, that was such a profound experience for me. I go, I've got it now. This is it. It's nirvana. I'm enlightened. You know, it's like, that's how I felt. It was very exciting. And I did one really smart thing. I've heard all kinds of people, and I've tried this many times, about discipline. You get up in the morning at a certain time, find a place where nothing else happens but meditation. You sit there and you meditate every day, no matter what, no matter what. That does not work for me. It just doesn't work for me. And I've tried many times to do that. And I'll go for a period of time and then it just peters out. So this time I consciously gave myself permission to meditate when it happens. And it happens pretty much every day. There's a point in the day where I'll just kind of go out. Sometimes for 2 or 3 minutes, sometimes for 20 or half an hour, sometimes 45. You know, sometimes I'll go sit in the backyard and it just comes over me and I just relax into it. You know, one of the things I talked about with him last night was that I'm having a real hard time connecting even when I do it. There's periods of desolation and consolation. But every time I've attempted to advance my spiritual growth, there's so much ego involved in that, I think that it flies in the face of what you're actually trying to accomplish. You know? I mean, you're trying to rid yourself of self. So yourself is trying to attempt to rid itself of itself. And I maybe for some people that works. You know, it doesn't click for me. And so this undisciplined approach with a little discipline works.
I've been bringing him Eckhart Tolle tapes for years.
Here he goes.
But he couldn't hear it from me. He couldn't hear it from me. It's just another... It's him again. I have always had a spiritual teacher that I'm working at or working with. Right now it's Matt Kahn. Joel Goldsmith has been the kind of the keel of my boat for the past 25 years, the Infinite Way. Thomas Keating, Paul Gorman, a bunch of others. Not one of them did I not have to go towards. I'm the one that has to make the motion. It's like not drinking. It's not just going to happen with me. So I've got a committed practice that I do. And that practice changes a lot. It's not the same all the time. But I am always going towards it. And that's just my story.
Anybody else? Zach.
You know the African story about the forest that's on fire and there's a bird going and he's getting one little drop out of the river or the ocean and coming back? No. I can't get out of my head. I don't know what
that was your question. Anybody else? All right, I think we are concluding our session here. So why don't we circle up and pray?
Wait a minute. Before we do that, I want to do one thing. We like to end with this. I think it's very, very powerful. It's not me. This is written by someone else, and I'm simply going to read it.
Are we going to break it up?
This is, no, doesn't work that way.
It is him now.
Too confusing. This is a poem called I Stand by the Door, and it was written by Sam Shoemaker. And Shoemaker was the Episcopal priest at Calvary Chapel in Calvary Mission and the head of the Oxford Group movement in the United States, where it's where Ebby Thatcher came from when he went to Bill. And when Bill went looking for Ebby, that's where Bill went. And Shoemaker became a real mentor of Bill Wilson. And Shoemaker was a very vibrant, charismatic, wonderful speaker, wrote a lot and stuff, and he wrote this poem. And it's not specifically about AA, but you know, see if you don't think it reflects what's going on. This is the AA that I know, that I got raised in. And if it isn't yours, you might want to look for this, because this is, I think this is the essence of it. So I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world, is the door through which men walk when they find God. There is no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man can do is take hold of one of those blind groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside the door as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they have not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. I admire the people that go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet even found the door, or the people who want to run away again from God. You can go in too deeply and stay in too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place, near enough to God to hear him and know he is there, but not so far from men as to not hear them and remember they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them. Millions of them. But more important for me, one of them, two of them, 10 of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I had rather be a doorkeeper. So I stand by the door. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.